Dad Bod Rap Pod, episode, drumroll, 14, where we will be looking at the year of 1988, when I was just a wee lad. Were y'all even born? I really feel like I was afraid to broach the topic because I feel like I was a fully functional person with an agenda in 88.
I was in second grade.
Okay.
Yeah, same here. Same here. So fully functioning agenda.
Deep exhale on that. All right.
My agenda was like pizza day.
Man.
Of that nature.
Thursday, the
mine still is. Huh?
sourdough bread pizza. Gosh. So yeah, 1988. We're going to get into it. We each have an album from 1988 that we're going to talk about a little bit in depth. But before we get into that, we'll get into the introductions. If this is your first time listening to the Dad Bod Rap Pod, you're 14 episodes behind. Don't trip. You can binge it. It's like Breaking Bad. You'll catch up very quickly. On my right, I have the incredible super fan, as it were, Mr. Nate LeBlanc. How's it going?
What's up, world? Everything's good, man. Can't complain.
Yeah?
I would if I could. You know this.
That's true. But who cares?
Literally no one.
Yeah. And on my left, we have hip-hop writer extraordinaire. You've seen his stuff in Wax Poetics, amongst other fine publications. Mr. David Ma, how's it going?
Hey, what's going on, guys? Really happy to be here.
Man.
You know, congrats to you guys.
Man, yeah, we keep chugging along. Here at Tone Freak Studios, we have Mr. Jerry D on the mix right now. And so, yeah, so 1988, let me set the stage because I feel like for 87% of our listeners, they're like, I was 3 years old at that time. So 1988, there's still a Soviet Union. If you don't know what that is, go ahead and Google that. Number one song in America was Don't Worry, Be Happy by Bobby McFerrin. Some important to Nate, Skrillex was born in 88. Top movie, best picture of the year was Rain Man. Also in that year, we had Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Coming to America. So an interesting year overall. We're getting the garbage truck coming in to collect. We're doing this actually outside on 8th and Martha. It's a live taping. There's a homeless man's getting kind of agitated with this. All right, so that's 88. We're still on like VHS, you know, cable is in there, but not super deep. Nate's in second grade. So is this up that you came upon, this album that you came upon? You're in second grade, or is this kind of like a
I
later?
Came upon it later.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say though, at the time, I was listening to Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince,
absolutely.
Kid and Play, kind of your like youth-oriented hip hop acts. I was really into the Fresh Prince song "You Saw My Blinker." Do you guys know that song?
Man.
It's about road rage, essentially.
Wow.
Yeah, I loved that song. Wow. And by the a couple years after that, I started getting into like Ice Cube and
sure, Lynch there was
Mob
a turn
and all that stuff. Yeah,
there was definitely a turn.
At this point, I was just kind of still in the kiddie realm, but. My album that I'm going to discuss today is Critical Beatdown by Ultramagnetic MC.
Nice.
An all-time classic. There's kind of, you could, if you were so inclined, kind of point to this as a mark of demarcation. Like, this is when hip-hop starts to get weird in the best possible way. So, the group is Cool Keith, Sed G, who's the main beat maker and the kind of the second MC. Mo Love and TR Love, not related as far as I know. And the fascinating thing that I learned in researching this little segment is that they're in high school.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yep.
That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Except for, you know, Nas was in high school
sure.
or should have been going to high school when Illmatic came out and Outkast was in high school when Southern
Playlist
came out. But
Sed G sounds like your dad.
I know. I have to say, I used to hate Sed G. Like, I used to, like, try to forward all of
Sed
his verses.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I just, clearly he's the lesser rapper, and like he's very important to the group for providing balance, and it can't all be so weird, but I've really come around on that. Like, okay. I've come to appreciate Sedgy and his kind of stentorian delivery. You know what I mean? It's just like his stuff is also super weird, but no one could ever out weird Cool Keith, so don't try.
Right, sure.
You know what I mean? So some of the standout tracks include Ego Trippin'. Same old rhythm that a baby can pick up and join right with them, but the rhymes are pathetic. They think they quote aesthetic using nursery terms, at least not. Which, if I were pressed, I would say is one of the best verses of all time. Like, this is kind of like Cool Keith, like, redoing the template and coming with just this amazing verse. There's other great songs like Watch Me Now and Give the Drummer Some, and it's just a really solid album. It's, you know, a single LP length, not too long, and it just basically changed hip-hop. It just expanded the possibility of what you could do rhyme-wise, and Cool Keith said in an interview by a little-known writer called David Ma for Wax Poetics that they weren't trying to be abstract per se, but that they were trying to live out their fantasies on wax, and that they wanted to be lyrical and sound like they were from outer space.
Mission
and all
accomplished.
All of that happened.
That's so perfect.
The kind of production template is super bright, super attacky, mm-hmm. and super well-tuned drums, which you have to give a lot of that credit to Paul C.
Of course. I was going to say, Paul C was a
legendary engineer and really helped shape this album. So basically this is kind of the beginning of the legend of Cool Keith, and I found out about it much later. Probably I would say once I got obsessed with Dr. Octagon in like 96, it's like, where's this guy come from?
Yeah.
Let me go back in time. And that's when I started doing my research. So, I have one little kind of funny story. This is a very obscure reference. In the, inner sleeve of what it was, the CD at the time, it's the back cover of the record, T.R. Love is wearing this t-shirt that says "So Hot It Hurts" in this kind of like you know what I'm talking
about,
Dave?
It's the best.
So
don't you have that shirt?
Okay, this is where I'm going with this. So I'm like an obsessive fan, right? I see this, I'm like, I love that shirt. Early kind of internet days of t-shirt emporiums, I go and order it. I'm like this short, stubby dude with a beard wearing this shirt that says "So Hot It Hurts."
Yes.
And I used to DJ a lot. I'd wear it to my gigs and stuff. And like maybe one person ever got it. Like that's a pretty obscure low percentage reference, right? So it just looks like I think I'm like hot, right? And then so I basically had to retire the shirt from the rotation because no one got it. Like Dave would get it and literally no one else in the world.
I think it's time to bring it back, man.
I know, totally.
Yeah. The older you get, man.
I'll have to sew some panels into the side. but yeah, if you've never heard it, really take the time to go listen to Critical Beatdown by Ultramagnetic MCs. It's just it's a phenomenal album.
Ultramagnetic MCs, Critical Beatdown, also was Cool Keith taking a shot at Run DMC.
Interesting.
He goes, say what? Peter Piper, hella childish rhyme.
Oh, right.
You know what I mean? And to me, I was just like... How are you going to take a shot at Run DMC?
Interesting.
It was they were very, very bold.
He's not down with the record. King.
Not at all. Not at all. An atheist to Rev Run.
Right.
But, yeah.
I never like read that as a diss. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think when I interviewed him and I brought it up, and he was like ambiguous about it years later.
Right.
Saying, really? Like, hey, you know, he stepped back on it a little bit.
Okay.
But
okay.
It definitely sounded like a diss.
Yeah, right?
Especially the era. So.
Yeah. Because I love disses. He goes, they use the simple back and forth, the same old rhythm that a baby could pick up and join right with them.
Ooh.
Wow. That's smoke in 88.
They
were bringing the smoke in 88.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Excellent choice. Like a fine wine, gets better with time. Mr. David Ma, when you were in second grade writing for the school newspaper about lunchtime battles.
That's hilarious.
What record was it for you?
Well, for me, I'm 38, not 48, so I probably came across this album in the mid 90s, and mine is Slick Rick's Greatest Adventures, of course. And you know, having said that, by the time I came across it was already a decade old, and it's crazy. I mean, it's crazy how music strikes you because it enters your timeline, and it's and it can be the most epic shit ever that's already existed in the world, but your mind is being blown for the first time. I mean, I can assume it's the same for any kid who's going to pick up Introducing or Donuts, you know? But anyways, I digress. So I heard this shortly after Doggy Style came out, because I remember hearing Lottie Dottie and being like, oh, this is not a Snoop original? Because, you know, I'm a freshman in high school or something. And after that, I dove into Rick's catalog, and he remains top five for me for sure. And like I mentioned prior, what I've always loved about hip-hop is humor. And, you know, you can be braggadocious, you can, you know, have amazing production, but humor and this sort of lack of seriousness and storytelling always struck me. And it should be noted that the producers on here are credited to Jam Master Jay, Rick himself, and the rest was Bond Squad, minus Chuck.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I have a little anecdote on that later, but I was lucky enough to speak with Rick a couple times. One was for Wax Poetics, and then it ran again for Wax Poetics Japan. And, you know, I'm stoked because, I mean, obviously, it just speaks to his towering influence that I'm doing this piece on him 20 years later, 20 years removed from when the album came out. And so the song that I want to pick that sticks out to me is Teacher, Teacher.
Teacher, teacher, tell me how you do it. It looks kind of easy like there was none to it. But they don't understand that the man's will be the creator of the star. Teacher, teacher, tell me how you do it. It looks kind of easy like there was none to it. But I don't understand that the master will be the creator of the star.
And it's funny, so when I did interview Rick, he said that he thought the song was garbage.
He's really?
Like, yeah. And that's like one of my favorite tracks on there, you know?
He's the one guy, huh?
I know. I mean, we're talking about an album filled with Lottie Dottie, Children's Story, all the classics. But I'm going to read a quick passage from the interview with him. So says Rick, certain beats and me don't work. Teacher, Teacher was garbage. No disrespect, but it was filler to me. I mean, you got people working on a record behind the scenes who have to keep score of what the public would like. And that's when they brought in the Bomb Squad. I mean, sometimes a good beat just doesn't bring out the best in an MC or vice versa. And this was the case with the Bomb Squad. I liked their beats, but it didn't work well with my style. So, I mean, it's just another example of when a fan is totally in love with the offering, but the artist doesn't. You know what I mean? And you just have no idea what goes on behind the scenes. But this album, I mean, speaks to me because obviously it's influence, right? I mean, you can hear it from anybody, from Nicki Minaj to Kendrick to Biggie or anyone who's ever switched up their voice or added another dimensional character to the arc of the storytelling. And or even in Jay-Z's Fade to Black when he's making 99 Problems and he goes to Rick Rubin and he's like, I'm going to slick Rick this. So, you know, when your moniker has turned into a verb, it really speaks to it. And not to further name drop, but one more thing. When I interviewed Ghostface, and on the cover of, on the cover of the Pretty Tony album, where Ghostface is wearing that big Jesus piece, it was apparently given to him by Slick Rick before he hit the stage. And Ghostface says that, you know, Slick Rick is tops for him as well. So, you know, it's good enough for Ghostface. It's good enough for me.
Isn't this one of your favorite records of all time?
Yeah, of all time.
Yeah,
100%. So that was an easy pick for this segment.
Yeah.
Yeah, that record was like sex education
for
me at the time.
So
yeah.
Funny, his voice. Yeah. I mean, has anybody really done the voice changes as well?
No, and it's always just reverential to
right,
Slick Rick.
Right.
It's like you people just have tried to, you know, Dell did that, Biggie
sure.
did that on certain tracks. But as an MC, I definitely, and a lot of folks definitely studied this idea of rapping over yourself. And mm-hmm. rapping and having these kind of dueling tracks
right.
going back and forth at each other. So super heavy record, Teenage Love.
Right. Jeez, forgot about that.
Yeah, that was the feels back in 88. Awesome. All right. So Critical Beatdown, The Adventures of Slick Rick. This was a heavy year, man.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
that's kind of why I wanted to go back into it. It's like Murderer's Row. There's just so many good things to choose from. Eric B. and Rakim Follow the Leader is one that I don't
right.
think made the cut today. It's just like, do a show on that.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, and it was this year, I think, that beats and rhymes were at an equal level of innovation. So, you know, it seems like folks had kind of just figured out the samplers. It doesn't mm-hmm. have that raw early 80s feel. It's not about
right.
bands anymore. It's not about rappers are really experimenting. In 88, everybody had their own personality.
Right.
You know, there weren't two Slick Ricks. There was one. Right. There was one Cool Keith. Still only one Cool Keith. So in that vein, I'm going to go with another kind of iconic record that came out in 1988 that just has incredible significance for me. And that's It Takes a Nation of Millions by Public Enemy.
Of course.
88 was a seminal year for a lot of reasons, but one of them was we got cable. So cable finally made its way to, you know, my semi-suburban San Jose neighborhood. We're like the last neighborhood to get cable. And what this meant is that I had access to Yo MTV Raps. So prior to that, I was kind of just tethered to whatever was played on the radio and didn't really know too much about East Coast rap in general. I was more like, you know, Rodney O and Joe Cooley, MC Hammer, those kind of groups of the day. And so watching Yo MTV Raps, the video for Night of the Living Bassheads came on, which on a future show, we'll talk about greatest videos of all time. This is one of the greatest rap videos of all time and maybe had a $7 budget. But the color, the noise, the sound, the characters, it was my first introduction to Chuck D, this booming voice, like the older brother you never had coming in and telling you about rap. Flavor Flav being the Joker in the deck, this kind of colorful hype man, like just wigging out. So my first introduction to Public Enemy was like this visual of seeing that video. My older cousin had it, dubbed it from him, dubbed the tape, and pretty much listened to it every day for about 18 months or something like that. My kids crack up because if I put it on in the car, I will rap it word for word, every skit, every ad lib, you know, it's like being possessed. So it was a huge, huge record for me. Number one, the content of it. I'm 12 in 88, kind of going through that who are you identity thing, being a black kid and having Chuck come through and introduce black nationalism in this kind of format was huge for me. So I joined the fan club. I bought the medallions.
Is that really true? You literally joined the fan club? I was part of the fan club. Because,
wow.
They had an order form where you could order the Public Enemy medallions.
Yeah.
Like I was all in. And his kind of content and his delivery, and he was older at that time. I think he was like 27 when this record came out. So he kind of had this authoritative voice and the way he came through. And then you pair that with the Bomb Squad's production, which may not have worked for Slick Rick, but
it certainly works for Chuck D.
For Chuck D and Public Enemy, coming out of 1987's Yo Bum Rush the Show, which wasn't, you know, commercially a smash, but they toured a lot that year. And they went back in the studio saying, we want faster songs to play at shows. And so it's this up-tempo, absolute chaos. It's really, you know, organized chaos that the Bomb Squad put together. And it's really a technical achievement because they're not working with, you know, the Pro Tools in this type of software where you could line up 22 samples and cut them up. They're literally using tape loops. So they're splicing tape with a razor blade and taping it together. Which is just a technical achievement in and of itself, but it provided this perfect backdrop to kind of Chuck's booming, authoritative vocal. And then, you know, Flav punctuating it, greatest hype man ever, Flavor Flav. And so I listened to it. I internalized it. It became me, shaped my not only my musical taste, but my political thought. And so one day I go to school. I'm in sixth grade, and we're doing a poetry unit. And the teacher says, you know, find a poem, bring it in and share it. So I brought Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn, I said no.
And so, as you can see, Chuck starts off top that, you know, he got a letter from the government. He opened and read it and said they were suckers. You know, he's not going to the army, which my teacher was like, what is this? It blew both of our minds. She's like, how could somebody say that? And I was like, word, I'm not going either. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
So even that idea of, you know, I had to go and ask, like, what did he mean by that? And it's like, you know, my cousin was like, well, there was a draft, and, you know, kind of breaking that down. And so just on so many levels, an incredible record, incredible skits. You know, it's one of those kind of seminal pieces of the 80s, I think, even from a pop culture perspective. Mm-hmm. And bringing kind of political influence into rap. So I could probably do my own solo podcast on It Takes a Nation of Millions, but yeah, that would be the record for me.
Oh, perfect. I mean, yeah, all those are really hard to argue with. Just reminds you of how fertile that time was.
Yeah. In record collecting, it's kind of like 88 ends an era, and then in 1989, there's all these, like, what are now called random rap, but are mm-hmm. what are really shitty, like, home-recorded takes on rap, usually in the kind of up-tempo drum machine
right,
style.
Right.
Okay.
And it's like, in 88, everything was, like, seminal, and then in 89 everyone thought they could do it.
Sure.
Like I mm-hmm. you know, would buy any hip-hop record I could. I used to, on our old our first blog, I had a column called Bad Rap, and it was like we were about to start getting into these terrible records, and I think it's because people were so inspired by mm-hmm. this, like mm-hmm. this flowering of the golden age.
Sure.
Right, it's like,
sure,
of course you're going to be inspired by EPMD right. or Chuck right. D or Public Enemy or Slick Rick right. but that doesn't make you
totally
Slick Rick. It right. makes you like some guy,
right?
And so there's all these terrible records of people
really?
Who thought they could rap. It's kind of the beginning of that, as far mm-hmm. as I can tell.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There,
okay,
up until that point, most people had a point of view. I think people saw that hip hop was something you could do to make money, and something that, like, mm-hmm. it's just talking over a beat, right? How
right.
hard could it be?
Right.
So there's all these, like, awful records.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
kind of
okay.
like the backpack movement, right? Anyone
yeah.
can make it in their bedroom.
Right.
You know?
That, is, wow. Okay. I'd love to, I got to circle back on the,
yes,
on the blog there.
I got a box full of records in my stairwell of collected from that time, the ones that aren't worth money and are terrible. It's like, that's
the bargain,
the
bargain bin.
Yeah,
man. So 88 was like, is that the beginning of the quote unquote golden era?
It's right in there.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, there's always these parentheses that people are very strict about, but
maybe,
you know,
earlier.
You're saying 88 to 94?
I don't know. That sounds right.
Give
to
or
me.
Take a year. Right?
Yeah,
yeah.
Around there somewhere.
Yeah, it's got to
okay.
be.
Okay.
That's the best stuff, where people had budget, people could
mm-hmm.
sample freely,
mm-hmm.
people
oh,
like
man.
People were kind of
right.
like liberated
right.
by Rakim to explore different themes.
Totally.
I don't know the exact dates,
right.
but
and the sampling rights thing, I mean,
tons of stuff
yeah,
I love is
ridiculous.
You know, came out at that time.
Beastie man. Boys, Biz, I mean, just
yeah.
samples galore.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like that was that moment where, you know, beats were still, you know, they hadn't perfected the hip hop beat
right.
yet. And so it's just, there's so much experimentation going on. And I wonder, in your 89 corollary to when Bad Rap started to happen, I would like to see a flow chart of, like, how many records came out of the West Coast after that?
Mm,
like
right.
and kind of mm. in other kind of locales.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Kind of,
you're out of the tri-state area at that
yeah.
point. You
right.
start to get your flowerings of your scenes
right.
around the country.
Right. National magazines, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and then I guess, you know, Def Jam going on tour, I think, probably had a lot to do with it too.
Yeah.
Of getting folks there. So 88, it was a great year in hip hop, and now we are 25 years removed
Jeez.
From 88. Jeez Louise. Is it possible to have another 88? Will we look back? Or
aren't
is that
30 years?
Isn't are we 30 years?
Isn't that why we're doing
you're,
this?
You're our math guy. I depend on you to make sure that the numbers line up.
We did 98. It was 20 years ago.
Oh, damn man. It. Damn yeah. it. So on the next podcast, we're going to shout out Jerry's year 78.
Play the 15-minute version of Rapper's Delight and
yeah,
rap along.
Exactly.
I got the cheese verse.
Oh, man. So, yeah, so 1988, an amazing year in hip-hop. How important is it to new listeners? How do you guys feel about that when people say, well, these kids should go and check out, you know, does it matter if a 19-year-old goes and checks out 88?
Does it matter? No. I think, like, for their life experience as a human, sure. But,
right.
You know, it's always good to have to know your foundational sounds and where everything came from. But, no, I mean, you know, when we first heard Tribe, we liked it. And I didn't you know, I wasn't deep on Melly Mel, you know?
Sure.
So
sure.
I think there's an innocence there that we're maybe, you know, projecting.
I think these, especially with this, which guy is it this week who doesn't like Tupac? Little Xan.
Oh, yeah.
Little Opioid.
Yeah. One, yeah. Who cares what he thinks?
Right.
Two, it only makes the news if he doesn't like it.
Right.
No
right.
one's going to write a blog about how much this kid loves Tupac. Right. It's, you know, it's, right. it's a controversial opinion. They're all about getting face tattoos and taking right. drugs and saying fuck you to the system.
Yeah,
if
sure.
the system is Tupac at this point, then
damn.
That's
yeah.
kind
just,
of
just
what,
let them be.
That's what they're rebelling against, right. and that's fine.
You're rebelling against Tupac. That is an incredible sea change in terms of
right.
in terms of rap, when Tupac is the staid kind of mm-hmm. crusty thing. It used to be Jay-Z. 10 years ago, it was really cool to be like,
yeah.
I'm not like Jay-Z. Fuck that. We're new.
Right.
We're new.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I happen to like the music my parents liked, but most kids don't. Right?
Right.
It's like we kind of got lucky. It's like the kind of 60s classic rock that's like
sure. right.
seminal to sure. American and British culture, right? It's a
sure.
that was a sea change at that time and something I could get behind. I just happen to like it. I think a lot of kids grow up not liking their parents' music, and their parents' music, if you're a young person now, is probably hip hop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's because
hip hop took over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really did, and I struggle because on one hand, you know, you do want your kids to be like, hey, man. Listen to this. Like, my mom used to berate me about Ice Cube stuff because he was always ripping off George Clinton. And she would be like, that is just funkadelic XYs. And I'd be right. like, yeah, but it's new. And then later on, like, yeah.
I would no. say he's paying George Clinton.
Right.
Yeah, hopefully.
He's keeping George Clinton relevant.
Man, but boy,
Bop
did
Gun,
he ever.
He literally guested. You know, it's like,
yeah.
It's the
yeah.
one, like, they're still touring, I would say, and I've had this argument with other people, more off of G-Funk than they are off of their real records.
Like, well, they extended
Donald
the run.
Donald Glover is doing their real records, but
right. Right.
Snoop Dogg yeah. and Dre were taking the best parts of, you know, those, and those are the classics now.
I mean, is Blue Note Records even functional without their kind of this, like, renaissance of all the breaks that were
right.
looted from? I mean, right. they've released so many, like, Blue Note breaks.
Right,
and,
right. Totally.
And
I would say
things.
Because of Norah Jones a couple years ago, maybe that first album of hers that won all the Grammys was on Blue Note. But, like,
oh, was it?
Yeah. But that Mad Lib Shades of Blue album is more important to my friends, right?
Totally. Totally.
So
there it is. Rap, number one genre. Pumping life into all your dead genres.
100%.
Understand it, deal with it, reflect on it, Little Xan. And we'll be back for more Dad Bod Rap Pod. Dad Bod Rap Pod, episode 14. Continuing our kind of deconstruction of the year 1988, we're going to get into Slept On Gems. And so these are joints that, you know, we feel are amazing, but for whatever reason aren't necessarily heralded as the great hip-hop songs that they are. So we're each going to share a little bit about our Slept On Gems, and we're sticking to the theme of Slept On Gems from 1988. And we'll start with Mr. Nate LeBlanc.
So my Slept On Gem from 88, and that this is always a weird line because it's like, to a head, this is probably kind of a common song, but right. it seems like that's not really who's listening to our podcast. It's like, tends to be more of a general listener. So I'm going to go with JVC Force,
nice.
Strong Island.
Yes.
listen to the situation, my son. I'm as serious as cancer, all fun and done. For the time, the people correspond the rhymes to is valid. The best you will find.
Living in CI, who the hell am I? AJ Rock, the juice, I can fly. Cool with the riffing guy, keep a handle. Cause if you don't, I'll wax it down like a candle.
Just an awesome track. I love that kind of buzzsaw guitar from the Frida Payne Unhook Generation. As I was listening back to it today, I realized it's kind of an EPMD song. Like, it sounds a lot like EPMD. Mm-hmm. It's kind of clearly in the lane that they created. It's kind of a suburban New York song. It's got a huge sample. It's kind of dubby, and there's like kind of effects on everything. And then there's kind of these kind of like talking verses. But to me, this is what hip hop is all about. This is like a kind of straightforward, really thick sounding slab of beats and rhymes. And I could listen to stuff like this all day and oftentimes do. So I just want to kind of make sure that more people are listening to stuff like this. And my only little anecdote about this song is that the record collecting grail for this song is the blue version, which was out on B-Boy Records.
Okay.
But it has this kind of like really staccato scratched intro that I don't like. I like the album version, so that's what I brought for this. And I kind of don't have a ton to say other than that I love this song, and I wish there were hundreds of more songs like it. And
JVC Force is kind of a slept on group.
Yeah, you don't hear much about them these days.
Yeah, and it was almost, and I love your EPMD kind of comparison, because to my mind, I kind of thought they were a little bit better lyrically than EPMD. Maybe not as catchy, and maybe that's why it never kind of happened for them.
Yeah.
I know there's a thread of hip hop where their fashion from this period is held kind of in very high esteem. I'm not that fashionable, but I know some of my Supreme type older cats really vibe off of what they were rocking on that album. Mm.
Nice.
All right. Mr. David Moss, Slept On Gems from 1988.
So just kind of while doing, kind of overlooking all my notes and everything, 1988 was such a rich year, right? I mean, we mentioned EPMD. We mentioned other Eric B. and Rakim. I mean, Juice Cruise, the symphony came out the year. I mean, geez,
Never heard of it.
This guy sucked. But my Slept On Gem is from Super Lover C and Casanova Rudd. And as much as I love Girls, I Got 'Em Locked, the song I really like is Super Lover.
I'm back for chill, home girls, don't mob me. Y'all can slob me down, but don't rob me. I'm super loving, so come one at a time. Because when it comes to crowds, I bust rhymes. Doping them up, synchronize so precise to make my jams. Nice.
And I like it because it's sort of their official joint anthem, and obviously the drums on it knock. And we touched on this earlier, but Paul C was also responsible for that. And I sort of got into Paul C in the early aughts of the 2000s, reading Dave Tompkins' epic Paul C article. I mean, that should be the reference point. And for those who are unfamiliar, I mean, Paul C is almost a mythical figure. For a few reasons. One, he's a white guy at that time. Two, sound engineering, forward-thinking production techniques, the way he layered sounds, and particularly the drums. I mean, and he's this guy that gets spoken in the highest regard by masters like Cool Keith and Large Pro. And Paul passed away sort of tragically, and I believe his murder is still unsolved. Mm. So that's sort of the lore behind it. And one of the main reasons I love the song so much is the production, because it's like it's its own lane. You just hear these layers that kind of come and go, and then you're reminded that it's from 88, and it's, and this is an era of Bomb Squad. So they were kind of right up there in terms of technicality. So I don't have much to say besides I love the song. Shouts to Casanova Rudd, who, when I was listening to this again, I was like, he had some modern cadences and sort of a, advanced delivery, up his sleeve, at that time. So, and aesthetically, it's playful. The rest of the album, I can't really get with some of the crazy misogyny, but that's a different subject.
Find an ugly woman? No? And make your wife? No?
It's not even funny, you know what I mean? But anyways, I digress. Having said that, love this one. What about you, Damon?
All right. So for me, it's definitely a group that everybody is familiar with, Audio 2. as Dave will tell you, I'm a big proponent of First Priority Records, Audio 2, MC Light, that whole kind of, for a 2-year stretch, they were putting out some incredible records. We all know about Top Billing, but my pick for Slept On Gems is a song called I Don't Care.
Yo, my name is Milk when Milk is on the mic. I say all the rhymes you MCs hate. I really don't care what you think or say. I gotta bust a rhyme in my own special way. Giz is my brother, Mom is my mother, D is my father. You say, why bother? Because they put me here on this earth. Light is on my side and she is worth more to me than you. Forget your crew, it doesn't matter what you say or what you do. I'll keep on rocking, I roll too quick. All you groupies,
now. And so the reason that I love this one is because it's kind of Milk D at his most nasal and just owning it. Like his flow, and you know, I hope he doesn't listen to this one day, but it's so annoying in a good way. It's in that ad rock kind of Be Real Cypress Hill lane where it's just so over the top. And on I Don't Care, he's taking some of the cadence he had on Top Billing, which is just kind of pitch perfect, and he's doing weird off-kilter stuff with it. In the first lines, it doesn't rhyme. Like, he's just he's doing weird stuff. The production is reminiscent to Top Billing in terms of the drum programming, which for me, Top Billing is the best drum programming ever. Like, the most simple but effective drum programming, and it's been sampled a million times because of that. But I Don't Care has a similar punchiness, and the pattern is just incredible, and it's just very, very simple, but direct. And that was kind of their formula back in those days. So you had Top Billing, I Don't Care as kind of a counter note to that, and then the MC Light stuff with Paper Thin and all these things. And so First Priority Record, started by Milk D's dad, in order just to put out his son's record.
Would you say that was his priority at the time?
Dad jokes here at the dad.
The second priority was like MC Light and all that stuff.
And they're related. Yeah, MC Light is Milk D's cousin. Oh. I never got to the bottom of it, but there's some lore that says she wrote some of the stuff for Audio 2.
That's interesting.
Which would be super interesting, but I haven't like got official word on that, so don't quote me. But yeah, that would be my slept on gem for 1988. So we should I don't know, follow us on Twitter. Like, we'll probably post links to these things. They're really, really incredible songs from an incredible era. We want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Dad Bod Rap Pod. As always, you can find us on Twitter at
Dad Bod Rap Pod
and on SoundCloud
/DadBodRapPod, all spelled out.
And we really welcome, if you feel a certain way about a take you've heard on here, feel free to add us, tell us we're wrong. But overall, thanks for listening. We got more incredible interviews and fly, wonderful conversation. Dad Bod Rap Pod.